Hold on. Going for the fifth attempt for Walt Disney.
Man, y'all in the superstructure too much.
Immediately delete all of this.
Yo,
I'm on.
Are y'all everything and everyone nowadays? Because y'all motherfuckers are the spectacle.
Fuck, delete it.
Yeah, we have
no,
to delete all of
this. Here we go. Am I Diane Arbus? Because I just got done with a photo shoot of a bunch of hairy freaks.
That's right, folks.
Hey, am I Charlie going to the chocolate factory? Because I just took a tour of some goddamn treats and snacks.
Am I Ouija? Because I just witnessed some crime scenes being photographed. That's very, very funny, and only only people of a high IQ will get that joke.
All Matt,
I want every one of them to DM me after this episode.
All of Matt's jokes are like about like Pokemon Snap today. Like, what the fuck is going on?
Ouija was a 1930s crime scene photographer in New York City.
Oh, of course, God. Dude. Yeah, I got
it. He's also known as the guy Peter Sellers stole the Dr. Strangelove voice from.
Yeah.
Really?
And he was the inspiration for Jude Law's character in Road to Perdition.
That classic character you all
that
love.
That classic character you know and love.
One of the finest actors of our generation. I'll
tell you about Jude Law, sir.
So, it's Riffin' with the Boys Day. Yeah. Joey Chapo.
You know, it's just been a really lighthearted week. So we're going to give you a lighthearted episode.
Yeah, like a lot of fun things have happened.
Honestly, look. Okay, so we did a photo shoot today. It was at an unreasonably early hour. For me, I'm not saying like for the world, but for me, I physically in excruciating pain.
It was 11 a.m.
I had to wake up at 9. I just sort of stayed up. I couldn't get to sleep. We had a guest lined up to talk about Gaza, but she couldn't do like the photo shoot, push it back. We're going to do it midweek, but In its stead of the serious episode today, like, I was just physically excruciating pain. I should get a Purple Heart for what I'm going through right now.
Brizzle mentioned the book. Of course, we will be, for the first time ever, doing a Chapo World Premiere reading of a sample from the book for the first time ever. But also, book related, sitting in with us this week, longtime friend, short time trader, Brendan James.
Hey, everybody.
It's very
Brendan's
awkward.
Super excited, too.
Because Brendan helped write the book. He's part of one of the author team. And then in the middle of that process, he abandoned us. Mm-hmm. And so now we have this awkward sort of, divorced parents coming together to visit their kid at camp thing.
Yeah.
Where he has to show up and do things for us, even though he has left
Brendan
us.
Brendan believed we betrayed the revolution, so he went to the hills with a small cadre.
I may not be too, I'm not going to pitch in as much, maybe, because I'm looking for what excerpt we should read, but I think I know what we should do. So we'll do that at the end. Always good to have Brendan back in, sitting in on the trap, even behind a mic instead of behind the boards.
Yeah.
So, as we mentioned, we just got done with a little photo shoot.
A little blow-up Chapo style.
Yeah, exactly. Did we inadvertently capture photographic evidence of a murder? I don't know. We'll find out later in the touch-ups. But before then, this week, nothing but terrible news. Just bad things happening all over the world.
Yeah.
Massacres in Gaza, another school shooting in this country.
Yeah.
Pretty grim all around.
Some brutal stuff. I may not be Leonard Cohen, but I have seen the future, and it is murder.
I don't know. Where do you guys want to start? Do you guys want to begin with your report from your field report from your trip to NYU?
Yes, I've got a dispatch from the field with my co-correspondent, Matt Chrisman. We were invited to go to the NYU Game Center for, I believe these were the senior projects of the game students.
The students who are learning to game.
Who are learning to make the game.
They're spending $500,000 to learn how to do gaming.
Have you ever wondered why every game there are like huge directional arrows telling you exactly what to do now? Well, they found out.
We were invited by
Jesse Fuchs,
our good friend from NYU, who is a professor of some sort of the introductory level of video gaming. So he teaches them to be cultural Marxists.
He teaches them how to do speed runs in Super Mario.
And they go through the process, and this is their final thing that they create after 12 years of being in video game school. And I would say it was fun. It was a blast.
It was interesting. There was a large variety of games. There were classic actual video games. There were tabletop games. There were deck-based games.
We played the Boy Band Simulator, which was based on the concept of those, you know, those Japanese dating
sims. Yeah, it's called Lou Pearlman 2K18. It's an extremely controversial game.
Okay, press X to lure this child onto your hot air balloon.
And when we were walking...
Press F to call your lawyer.
When we were walking around, I spied a poker table. So we went to this room that was the VR games.
That was the VR room.
And the game was not poker at all. I actually would not have minded just sitting down and playing poker for 6 hours. It was a VR game where you are a dealer in purgatory and you actually have to do the job of a dealer and deal the cards and everything. And the people playing the game are people trapped in purgatory, and I guess they tell you their stories.
Yeah. And then you develop relationships with them. The other one was...
Hold on a second. This game was just Purgatory Sim?
Yes.
What it's like...
Purgatory Sim...
But you're an employee of Purgatory.
Yes, exactly. You work in Purgatory, and you're a blackjack dealer.
Wait, guys, hold on a second. How about this? Purgatory.
I actually play...
would be heaven, sir.
Sign me up.
I actually play a mod of the Purgatory Sim called... Colob Sim. I'm actually ranked in Colob Sim. I main George Romney. People say that's cheap, but like, come on.
There were three. Another one was a bartender simulator. It was just simulating drudgery.
One of them was called a flight simulator.
Yes.
And it was a simulation of being on an airplane.
Yes. You're sitting
in an airplane.
You can interact with that shitty touchscreen thing they have there.
Like, you can watch a movie or play a game on the back of the other person's
That's
seat.
Pretty meta.
It's one of those things where
it's like, I get your point after 2 seconds.
Yeah, it's like, I get the joke. I don't actually need to play.
Is Gerard Depardieu an unlockable character in that?
It's like, fill five carafes of water on this
You could get the Flight 93 expansion pack where they hijack the plane and these guys are going to organize to, push a beverage cart through the fucking flight doors. But you just still sit there.
Well, that reminds me.
And you just still watch Lilo and Stitch.
Gamifying the plane does actually remind me of when we would take flights. Every time we got on a flight, my screen on the seat in front of me would light up, and it would be like, passenger 97 wants to talk to you about... And it would always be Virgil making use of the messaging system, which I don't think anyone's ever used before, and we would all click cancel, like, no, fuck off. No, I kept trying to talk to you guys.
I picked up never that, but I was right next
me
to
on the plane.
I responded with, are you horny? And it wasn't Virgil.
Man,
so
I can't imagine why you left.
Okay, it was a big thing. There were also tabletop games, and the... most interesting one was the simplest one. All of these games, like all of these, you know, seniors had like swag and shit. They had like cutouts.
Bells and whistles.
Yeah. Just all kinds of stuff to like draw you in, like the poker table for that game, which is unnecessary. Or there were bottles of liquor for the bartender game. The game that we spent the most time playing, to the extent that I think we chased away the creator of the game and she couldn't handle us, was a very simple card game. It's just a table with a few cards laid out on it.
It's just a deck of cards, basically. And it's actually ingenious. It was a combination of Clue and Apples to Apples, basically, is how I would describe it.
Which makes it sound terrible if you think about it.
But it was cool.
No, it was great. So the premise of the game is, flip a card, here's the victim. And flip a card, here's what they do. Here's something about them. Flip a card, here's where they were found dead. And you have five cards that indicate, like, plot points, basically. And you have to tell a story of how that person died. And you can play this with six people, and everyone tells concocts a story of how they died. And one person is a judge, and the judge has cards of
items.
They're
the detective.
The detective, yeah. And the detective has item cards that they throw in the middle of your story to kind of throw a wrench in it. And you have to improvise through
and
that.
And then they decide who told the most plausible narrative. It's actually very postmodern because it implies that there's no actual answer there's only the most satisfying narrative.
Yes, we all read the New York trilogy. I get it.
Yeah. I felt very Austerian playing it.
But Matt and I had a big disagreement at the table because I insisted that as a competitor, I should get to challenge your story. I should get to point out any logical inconsistencies that you make when you're spinning your yarn.
And I think everything needs to be determined by the cards you're dealt because that's what makes it a game. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of people having a conversation.
But it's a social game and an interactive game.
Right. But it has to be structured by the cards you get.
Oh,
you think conversation isn't a game? Social climbing is a game. I'm Mr. Robot. Welcome to Mr. Robot.
So we played this game multiple times, and like anyone could go to this event. And so there were just like normies there, and they could not handle us at all because we were spinning some interesting
tales. Yeah, you guys were like Pickle Rick, doing all your cool jokes.
We were pretty epic. We would always incorporate bacon into all of our narrative.
What was the best actual video game you saw?
No, there were a lot of art games that were not designed to be enjoyable. And the games that were designed to be played looked, I don't know.
There was no Pac-Man. Somebody should have done
nobody
a Pac-Man.
Nobody reinvented Pac-Man, which is a big strike against
them. Here's what I thought. Somebody should have made, because like some of these people, they made games with cabinets, right? And I thought, imagine if one puckish student just went through, you know, spent $8 million to go to video game university and spent 87 years of their life there. And their senior project was making the video game from The Simpsons, My Dinner with Andre game.
Oh.
With the full cabinet with like all the controls, Tell Me More and all of that.
Trenchant
but a full game. And if that kid existed, I would have to give them all my money. That would be it.
To know the unknowable. To say the unsayable. By the way, Wallace Shawn, if you're listening, please come on the show.
Yeah, come on the show.
Wallace Shawn, come on Chapo, please.
Or Cumtown, if you want. The best game was the game that we played and argued about a lot, and that I think that woman who could not handle us and wanted us to go away very much so should kickstart it for $83 million. And you will get a fine sawbuck from me for a copy of that game.
What was the name of the game?
I don't remember.
Man, you guys learned a lot there.
This is like Beavis
and Butthead going on a field trip. Just fucking pointless.
It's like
a report on like the shape of the ice cubes in the soda that you had.
So as I mentioned earlier, this has been a week of all just completely bleak and dystopian news. Chief among that being what's going on in the Gaza Strip right now. Just the wholesale massacre of protesters by the IDF. I think we should let you know that we are going to have another episode about this topic, speaking with a guest who can speak more deeply and intelligently and from experience about this thing, because I think it's an issue that warrants a deeper dive. We'll limit ourselves this week to, I think, discussing some of the media reaction to this has been really stunning, and it really goes to show you just how into overdrive the propaganda arm of like the Israeli government and Israeli lobby in America is to like not just apologize or cover up this or, you know, shove it to the side, but not, like, I think we are seeing a transition now where the official organs of like I said, Israeli propaganda in America are just openly embracing this now.
Mm-hmm. Senator Chuck Schumer, welcome to the resistance.
Mm-hmm. Openly embracing, and the New York Times is as good as any, a bellwether, like the crown jewel of the liberal media. And in their actual opinion section, the range of opinion on this massacre runs the gamut from Thomas Friedman saying it's an act of human sacrifice on behalf of the Palestinians to Barry Weiss saying the exact same thing.
Mm.
She went on Bill Maher's show on Friday and said all these Palestinians, they timed this, fence protest. They timed being murdered, including doctors and women and children, timed this to the photo op of the Israeli embassy.
The
American embassy.
How dare you make Jared Kushner look bad?
And she said just so they could have the split screen of Ivanka smiling, contrasted with, you know, men, women, and children being shot with high-powered rifles from hunting blinds by the IDF. And what she said on that show on Friday was, let's not give them what they want. So her argument is, these crafty Palestinians timed their protests to make it look make Israel look bad. So the way we beat them is to just not feel bad at all about, right, like I said, wholesale mass murder.
Right. This is, yeah, it's basically the Sharpeville massacre of the 21st century. But don't fall for it.
Yeah, don't fall for it. And here's the other thing, like the idea that somehow they're cheating because they timed their protests to make it more politically effective. Ooh, how dare they?
They're playoff protesters. Yeah, Israel's actions in Gaza in the last, say, like, since 2000.
Since Casled?
Or... Well, since Lebanon, okay, really. Yeah. Since their humiliation in the hands of Hezbollah has been, okay, we need to do a military demo to show our awesome destructive might against, you know, people who are pretty much helpless. But I think the other part of that has been, let's up the ante of what we can get away with.
Yeah.
Right. And the reaction to this in particular, because, you know, there has been a big liberal reaction of like, this is awful, this is blah, 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 which, again, I hate to be a pessimist. Like, I remember this type of shit under Bush. This is the type of thing where the liberal quarters, they notice something that is bad under a Republican president and you think it's a sea change and then they go back to conveniently not noticing it. I hope I'm fucking wrong. But, in the liberal quarters, yeah, there's been that. But I feel like with the reliably pro-Israel, more like American Likudnik set, it's been, okay, we're upping the ante to this. Yeah, okay. Full steam ahead. Let's go.
I'm just shocked that I'm on a show with these bros who are violating Barry Weiss's free speech right now.
Speaking of, like, Felix, as you said, like, pushing the limits, or like I said, that they're now, I think, There is, I'm noticing a shift in just the open embrace of this kind of murder and violence. Back in the pages of the New York Times, this one really stood out for me in terms of how just blood-curdling and awful it is. And again, I don't want to say shocking that this is in the pages of the New York Times, but I think it's very telling that the New York Times publishes this. Yep. Yep. And it's by Shmuel Rosner in the opinion section. Really distinguished himself with this one. The headline is, Israel needs to protect its borders by whatever means necessary.
But that's not a border.
Well, yeah. That, first and most important, this Gaza fence is not a border.
No.
It is not anything close to an internationally recognized border. If it was, it would beg the question, what nation are they crossing over from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They very, very consciously don't have a nation. And if they did, if this was a border, then Israel would be enacting a blockade of a sovereign nation, which is an act of war.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If they did have a sovereign nation, they would also have the rights to the natural gas in the Mediterranean in their territorial
They basically
borders.
Turned Gaza into the jail from Face Off. Not recognized by any government, a fucking phantom zone, something that is in a quantum state at any time.
Right.
It, depending on what you need for rhetorical purposes, right, it is a sovereign country or it's part of Israel. And it just shifts from one to the other.
Right.
And all that matters is that Israel, and this is the thing that matters more than anything, is that Israel is entirely responsible for everything that happens in Gaza. They created an open-air prison. They're in charge of everything that goes in or out of that place. They put up these fucking fences. They man them. They control how much water they get. They control how far they can go into the Mediterranean to seek fish. It is their creation. And then they say, well, look at what they did. But anything they're doing is literally what people would do in any kind of concentration camp.
Yeah,
like it's like judging the Sobibor fucking people for rebelling against the SS.
Also going all the way back, because I think Hamas is still a boogeyman. I don't think that's old, but it's just, there's this genocidal government and blah, 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 ignoring all the nuances that have actually taken place over the past basically like 15 years now.
And they wear masks.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. I think that's the image is still among people who don't either know or care a lot about this is they just think, well, yeah, but what are you going to do? There's terrorists running that strip. And apart from that being really essentializing what the government is there, it also excuses the massacre of innocents who have, you know, no stake in whether or not Hamas were to fall out of government or not. And they just live there. But that was a U.S. Egyptian Israeli forced error in 2006. When Hamas won the elections in 2006, freely and fairly by all accounts, and we sponsored a coup with Egypt and Israel to start a civil war between Fatah and Hamas, and then that resulted in Hamas being driven into super you know, militant mode and taking over Gaza. They were supposed to just be the regular government of the territory. So this whole idea, like, Hamas took over Gaza and it's a tyranny that they rule by, under a military dictatorship. It's like, that again happened. As you said, Israel owns everything. I think the U.S. also owns it and Egypt owns it.
Yes.
By making that into a hot, crowded corner of, I would say, yeah, a pretty authoritarian party, but one that resembles a lot of other authoritarian parties when they govern a place that has been made uninhabitable by the larger colonial neighborhood.
And also, stepping back another step further, a fucking party that was boosted at its inception by
Israel.
Fucking Israel, yes, to undermine the PLO.
Yes,
they got what they fucking wanted with Hamas.
That's true. Well, here's another thread to all this. A lot of the reaction I'm seeing about, like, these people who are being, again, just mowed down.
Yeah.
68 dead, but like thousands wounded.
Yeah.
And wounded here is like almost too weak a term. You're talking about being shot with high caliber bullets from sniper rifles, being maimed permanently for their, like, so like crippled for life or worse.
Yeah.
I'm asking. They're saying, oh, well, these people are Hamas, the people who are approaching the fence.
Oh my God.
Oh, they're Hamas or whatever. So?
Yeah.
I was about to say that. Yes. If Hamas is if you lived in the Gaza Strip, which, as we said, is a prison, is a functionally a concentration camp, and Hamas is the group that is organizing to stand up against your jailers or to even die in an act of, like, sort of defiance or even self-respect, like, instead of living on your fucking knees, good.
Yeah.
No, good for them. It's brave.
Any expression of militancy in that context is an expression of humanity. It's an assertion of one's humanity in the face of a hegemonic power that is denying you the ability to live at all.
And this is another thing that I think, Virgil, you nodded at before with the Chuck Schumer reference, is that the way that I would still say a lot of liberals, but mostly now, like, the real chest-beating conservative pro-Israel types, talk about this and talk about unarmed people, even though they don't consider them unarmed in some way or whatever, like, being gunned down and it's fine, they're in a way preparing you for more domestic insurrections in which black people or anyone of any class or any race want to rise up and, you know, for whatever grievances they have and are gunned down. They're saying, well, I mean, look, I mean, we saw this in Gaza, and are you really going to say those people were innocent? You know, the state needs to take the measures it takes. And we also remember that this stuff is not theoretical, and I'm not just pulling this out of my ass, because Black Lives Matter protesters during Ferguson, during Baltimore, were in touch with Palestinian people, because the strategies and sometimes the actual materiel were the same, were linked to the same ideas and tactics that Israel uses against the Palestinians. So this stuff links up beyond, oh, it's Israel, it's always going to be fucked up. They're talking about every event that could happen here too.
Yeah, I mean, IDF does train American cops too, but that point about, you know, this is, we could see this on repeat. You know, I really think we're going to see this on repeat, like a sort of gray area, stateless, non-sovereign, non-state, entering a non-border region that just at all costs cannot be let in. Mm. What do you think is going to happen when, you know, most of the world starts fucking sinking?
Yeah.
This is, if things don't get drastically better, this is what the future is going to look like.
The fact of the matter is, white people in this country would support putting walls and armed guards and dogs around every black neighborhood before they even think about reparations.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's citizens of the United States.
And what Felix talks about is that we like to imagine that there's a thing called human rights. But in reality, because of the international system of nation states, the UN, these concepts, your rights really are linked to your citizenship. Mm-hmm. And if you are deprived of citizenship in a mutually recognized sovereign entity, you're basically not a human being.
Same way that felons, that turning, you know, so many mostly black males into felons is a way to abrogate their rights. And then it's like, oh, well, we're dealing with criminals and drug dealers here. And then it's basically a racial caste system.
So the future is going to be creating these categories like the Palestinians, like refugees, like illegal immigrants who, by virtue of the fact that they have been forced by the vagaries of the power of others to try to seek some sort of life in any way they can, their assertion of humanity becomes a crime.
Right.
And because they cannot refer to a citizenship of a sovereign body that is mutually recognized by other countries, they essentially don't have rights, and they can be disposed of any way that the most powerful local government can imagine to do so.
You know what this also reminds me of is, remember when Trump said shithole countries?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the huge missed point there with, and this definitely was libs, is, okay, obviously he was being an idiot and racist and just probably thinking that entire cultures are shitholes, etc. But the idea beneath that, that these countries are in poor shape in other parts of the world, to say, oh, I'm so offended that he called them shithole countries, I'm sure they're vibrant places. Well, a lot of them aren't great places to live right now because of America.
Yeah.
Or because of other imperial designs that have been imposed upon them. And that is a more offensive thing and a deeper critique of American racism and foreign policy than just saying, oh, Trump was mean on the air once again.
Yeah. A great example of that sadistic line of thought is the Ben Shapiro thing, that quote that I never see in any of the fawning profiles of him, where he says,
Mr. Too Damn Logical.
Israel is just, Jews are just better than Arabs. Arabs like living, they like living in
Suez. They like living in Suez.
Settle in Iraq.
And he's referring to, of course, the Gaza Strip, where there is just open sewage. But again, this is a function of the absolutely conscious and systematic decisions by their jailers.
Yes.
That is the way to think about it. And I just want to say one other thing, like in sort of trying to metabolize the rotten and just morally hideous people who are trying to get you to like accept this or think that it is in any way just, will say things like, well, what are you going to do? They're armed. They want to cross this fence and they want to kill Jews. What are you going to do? Just let them across the border? Well, obviously, yes. Yeah. But the broader question is, in dying and in showing the world what Israel is prepared to do to stop them from crossing this, again, not border, I think it is important to show to the world exactly what the state of Israel has to do to maintain itself in its current form. And if you're okay with that,
right?
Well, then just fuck it. Like, forget it. Then you're admitting that you want to live in a state, or you think we should support a state in which this kind of wholesale murder is just the business, just doing business.
Yeah.
That's just how we
maintain. You want to live in a murderous war of all against all.
Yeah. And that's the undergirding conservative idea. And that we were talking about how this connects to Black Lives Matter and protests in the United States and also the American border with Mexico, is that the undergirding conservative idea is that you must, in any given situation, ignore the context that created what's happening.
Right.
If someone does something that you perceive as violent to yourself, that is hostility. Why they are in that position? Why are they deprived in this way? That is not something to be considered. That is sophistry.
Right.
Yeah. All that matters is that they're trying to get my stuff. Mm-hmm. Why I have this stuff and they don't have anything, That's for academics to talk about.
A perfect example.
Footage not found.
A perfect example of that, the IDF this week and their sort of savvy social media shop cut together a video of Palestinians, you know, approaching the fence and being tear gassed and shot. And they were like, the caption was, imagine you lived a mile away from this.
Right.
And the obvious question is, if the Gaza Strip had a fancy Twitter app, social media account, PR shop, they could make the exact same video asking the exact same question.
Yes, but it wouldn't work because they're pitching it to an American audience, and the American audience they're pitching that can only imagine themselves inside the gated community.
Right, right.
They cannot imagine themselves deprived.
They
cannot imagine themselves the one trying to fight for their lives. They are the ones on the other side of the thing. So, because that video you're talking about, it shows this sterile little suburb Israeli settlement. And then it pans out and it shows the border. And every American is subconsciously going to relate to that.
Yes. Right.
They're going to relate to that more than they can relate to any kind of abject lifestyle created by colonialism or imperialism or capitalism or anything, because they think that they're on the inside looking out.
Right.
And because of that, the appeal is going to be, these people are coming for you.
Right.
And you need to be able to do what you need to do to keep them from coming to your fucking door. It's David Thewlis.
It's literally the TV commercial of every Republican candidate running for office.
You're under siege. You have an amount, and maybe at some part, you have this patronage. You have this mess of pottage that you've inherited from your parents and your parents'
parents.
You have
a fucking house that's underwater.
Exactly. And maybe even, if you really interrogated it, you'd be able to say, I probably don't deserve it in any sort of philosophical sense, but it's mine. I'm not giving it up, and I'll do whatever it takes to protect it. And that's what binds the relationship to Gaza, to the American border. to black communities in America. It is that throw up the fences, put out the guards, shoot them so that I don't have to worry about them coming for my shit.
Well, we don't need to ventriloquize the thoughts of these people. Let's just read from them. This is Shmuel Rosner, again, writing in the op-ed pages of the New York Times, America's biggest paper.
The paper of record.
The paper of record.
It was brave of the New York Times to start putting triple parentheses around their op-ed.
The old gray man.
Let's listen to what Shmuel writes here. It is customary to adopt an apologetic tone when scores of people have been killed, as they were this week in Gaza.
Bitch-ass cuck move.
But I will avoid this sanctimonious instinct and declare coldly, Israel had a clear objective when it was shooting, sometimes to kill, well-organized, quote, this is in scare quotes, demonstrators near the border. Israel was determined to prevent these people, some of whom believed to have been armed, most apparently encouraged by their radical government, from crossing the fence separating Israel from Gaza.
Israel achieved all its objectives.
That
it completed all of its daily quests and received a loot box.
That objective was achieved. Of course, the death of humans is never a happy occasion. Still, I feel no need to engage in ingenue mourning. Guarding the border was
I'm a logic guy. I have no emotions other than rationality right now.
Guarding the border was more important than avoiding killing.
What border?
And guarding the border is
not a fucking border.
Is what Israel did successfully. Yeah, we've dispensed that.
You know, though, like this guy. This, I will take over the liberal Zionist line to this, which has been like, well, I love Israel, but I don't love this.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, what the fuck do you think
Israel means?
This is the exact idea that
Israel can't exist.
This is the exact idea that Israel was founded on, and that it's not a fucking border. In the founding idea of Israel, it is. Because the only border is between Arab and not Arab.
Yeah.
That's your border.
Yeah.
There's your only fucking border. There's the founding idea that undergirds all this. So
this is the reality of an ethnostate.
Yeah, to these freaks, to these people who, you know, the hand job at birthright was that much more evocative than the liberal Zionists.
Adam Friedland.
Like, God bless you. God bless you for, like, just giving me the ethnostate thing straight.
Right.
Fucking God bless.
No, it's the classic, you know, preference for someone who tells you at least what they actually believe over the...
Like this guy, that whole fucking paragraph oozes with self-congratulation because of his clear-eyed
realism.
Realism.
Well, it's the difference between the Trump supporters and the Never Trump people who substantially believe the same evil
things. Yes.
And I will say, though, before you go on, if you do go on about that guy, is like the I remember there have been a lot of activists or speakers who said that they don't really now, when they go on speaking tours or go to college campuses, which is obviously a huge battleground for all this stuff. A lot of them say from the pro-Palestine side that they don't really have to convince a lot of college kids anymore, including Jewish college kids. They're like, that battle is kind of over. Like, I'm sure, you know, there's still the Charlie Kirk style, you know, grandstanders, but like,
oh, you like socialism? How about living in Gaza?
Right.
Damn, got him, dude.
Yeah. So like, those guys are still there, but the real refusal to kind of grapple with the realities that actually happen in the West Bank and Gaza versus Israel, those don't seem to be that complicated for college kids anymore, and therefore the next generation of Americans and American Jews. But that just means that the Bret Stevenses and his ilk and the New York Times editorial guys who want to chime in are going to get more honest and more real, because they're not going to be able to really rely on slipping it by anybody anymore. They're going to have to go, if they're either with us or against us. So I'm just going to say, yeah, I like killing them. To paraphrase Chuck Schumer, for every one American Jewish college student they lose, they will gain five rabidly evangelical lunatics courting the end of the world.
Right.
Because, which, by the way, this embassy move to Jerusalem is 1,000% for the snake handling lunatics in this country who believe
Mike Huckabee went
that
there.
The rapture is going to happen in their lifetime.
Fucking Mike Huckabee,
can we find this quote, because it's genuinely amazing. It's a New York Times article about Huckabee and a bunch of the evangelical psychos going to the opening of the embassy in Jerusalem.
I think it's really amazing, and frankly, a sign of his commitment that Mike Huckabee keeps going to Israel, a place where he can't get his delicious fatback and pork sausage and wet ribs that he fucking subsists on. I like to imagine that when he goes to Ben Gurion Airport and they ask him if he has anything to declare, he's sweating bullets because he has 12 condoms full of pork gravy stuffed up his ass.
I love this fat, like, Goofy the dog's uncle character who's also a psychotic, ironically, given what his sons have done, but just that he's going back and forth to Israel on this like apocalyptic mission.
Yeah.
But he just showed like he's going there because he's like, oh, the world's going to end. I have to secure this for the forces of Satan to fight Jesus Christ forever. And all these people will go to hell. Like, it's very real and heavy to him.
Yeah.
But also, like, when he gets there, he's like, yeah, yeah, that there falafel looks like a big old ice puppy. Oh, by the way, all of you going to be exterminated in the war between good and evil. Hey, is that Tahiti sauce or is that ranch? Oh, boy, that's a long flight. I would take either. Hey, boy, them news guys sure been mean to my daughter.
I'm sorry, folks.
Hold on, y'all got a swimming hole over here? By the way, literally everyone you know will go to hell. And they're like, oh, this is fine. This is normal destiny for our people.
I'm sorry, folks. Egg on my face. The article wasn't, he wasn't there at the embassy opening. This article was from 2015.
You play the egg on the face noise. Flat.
What you going to do with them eggs? Try to make them into a little omelet? I like to put some pork gravy on that omelet and eat that up.
Yeah, I wish you got egg on my plate instead.
Wait, is Tim Faust in the room?
he does laugh like that. Yeah. Okay, this article's from 2015. The Huckabee goes to Israel. I stand here on Mount Carmel today, he continued, and I hope that, if called upon, I would be willing to stand all by myself and to call fire from heaven and believe that God will answer, even if there are hundreds and hundreds of false prophets on the other side. You may stand here someday and be called upon to call fire from heaven. I hope you're ready to believe that God will answer that prayer. He is casting Dungeons and Dragons spells. Yeah.
By the way, by the way, I hope that turns into melted caramel. All these Mossad psychopaths staring at him like, great speech, Governor.
I vow that I will stand at the Golden Corral and I will demand the prime rib, even if the carving station is out of it.
I don't even want to read any more of Shmuel Rosen.
No, we're fine. I just want to say one thing, though, about the fucking the Huckabee thing. A lot of people like to talk about how it is insane and horrifying that so many people in the highest echelons of our government are essentially apocalyptic psychopaths who believe that
millennialist Christians,
premillennial dispensationalists who want to.
Boy, they got a lot of Hebrews here in Israel.
Do. They want to destroy the temple on the rock. They want to rebuild temple or the dome on the rock to create the temple to bring about the apocalypse. That is fucked up. But honestly, it doesn't require evangelical mania to believe, to do the things that Israel and the United States have been doing.
It has made it more politically feasible over the past couple of decades, because 30 years ago, evangelicals were anti-Semites. Now they're all supporters of Israel.
Just two notes on the evangelical thing. The big difference is over the last 30, 40 years, the introduction of the completely made-up phrase and horseshit concept, Judeo-Christian.
Not a thing.
Yeah. Made up nonsense.
Tell that to the guys that Edward the First stuck on a fucking boat and kicked out of England. Yeah. Tell them that Judeo fucking Christian is a term.
I could have lived there. I could have lived in the movie Layer Cake, and now I'm fucking here.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Felix. You could not have lived anywhere.
Point number two about this idea that, as Ayn Rand said, the civilized man has, you know, a right to kill the barbarians. Yeah. What culture has Israel actually produced? Because as far as I can see, it's like EDM, DJ.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. What culture has the acts? Eurovision winner produced?
Yeah, they just won the Eurovision contest, sir.
Hey, Will, I've seen you wear capri pants. You know who you have to thank for popularizing that kind of thing? Will, I have seen you get into fussy arguments with guys over who's found the Marley and Me Blu-ray. Israelis invented that.
Yeah, Will.
Israelis invented wearing a lot of necklaces to go to restaurants called like Pizza Bonanza. Getting into shoving matches over complete nonsense.
Will, I've seen you send soup back at a restaurant because the temperature wasn't to your liking.
That is diaspora Jewish culture.
You're right.
And I've never worn capri pants ever. It's pure slander. Okay,
you should though.
The last point.
You look good in them.
The last point I want to make on, I do have nice calves. Thank you, Virgil. The last point I want to make on this, and like, do be serious for a second. The other thing the media response in terms of like the moral nihilism or just pure nihilism that's on display here is the Thomas Friedman said it, Shmuel said it. I'm not going to read the rest of his monstrous article, but this sort of hand wringing over how could they do this to themselves? Mm-hmm. It's human sacrifice that they're Thomas Friedman said they're throwing the flower of their youth away rather than, I don't know, teaching them to code or some bullshit like that.
Rather giardia in open sewers created by Israel.
What I want to say about that is, again, the fact that these people can't fathom the idea that that you would give your life for something bigger than yourself is very telling.
Yeah.
And I think that the people, the men and women and doctors who were blown away because they approached a fence or threw a rock did that knowing that they were facing death. And they did it anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that is the word for that is heroism.
It speaks to two things. Oh, it speaks to their heroism, a heroism that to borrow a term from my hated Pepe villains, small souled, can't imagine that kind of sacrifice. But also it speaks to the horror that Israel has created in Gaza, that living is no longer preferable if you can't live on your own terms.
Well, in any
and
other,
you're willing to fucking die for
in
it.
In any other context, like especially in American culture, we love the idea, like the phrase, better to die on your feet than live like a slave.
Right.
That's exactly what we're seeing
here. In our, like we talked about this in the thing about how, in the last episode, about how America turns Goliath into David.
Right.
And we have so many stories about Americans who are willing to do anything for their freedom. But when we see it happening somewhere else, it's clearly some sort of perverse death drive and cult created by some awful Hamas government or by the wickedness of Islam, and not people in an untenable, horrible, torturous, nightmarish existence created by our ally in Israel who are willing to do anything to try to stop it. And two things I want to say before we move on. Speaking of the doctors who went there, the medical staff, One of the medical staff who went there, a number of whom were shot, one of whom was killed, who went there to provide aid for the people who went on the march to the fucking fence, is a Canadian doctor named Tarek Lubani, who was shot in the leg and I believe is still recovering. And according to a friend of his who messaged me, is a fan of this show. And I wanted to say, and he asked if we could shout him out, and I say absolutely. And I think that you just want to talk about heroism. This is a person who is an absolute example of fucking heroism, and we should all
absolutely
thank him for his literal. That's actual service.
Yep. And another point I'd like to make on that: the IDF, when these things started, had a tweet that they hastily deleted where they said, "We know where every one of these bullets went.
Yep,
yep.
And all the shots are precise. They're firing. The snipers are firing these shots. They know exactly who they're pulling the trigger on.
Yep.
These people are." Clearly designated as doctors,
yes,
or
they have large symbol. The
same
Red
with
Cross. They have every indication that they are medical.
There
medical
is no
people. And the press people too that
they've. There
shot.
Is no conclusion other than they are intentionally targeting doctors and the press.
Yes. Well, many people point this out, but there were all those tweets of American hand wringers being like, "Oh, it's tough out there. You know, it's all a blur. You know, sometimes they don't know who they're hitting." And the classic two tweets next to each other response is all those versus that tweet of the IDF spokesperson going, "We know where every bullet landed. There were no mistakes. We come prepared. We know what we're going to do each time."
Is there anything that they can do to resist that?
No, you won't. Because BDS isn't good either. BDS is an act
that's
of war.
That's also violence.
BDS is violence and anti-Semitism. There is literally nothing.
Illegal in many jurisdictions.
There is, yes, and they want to increase that. They want to make it an illegal thing to participate in BDS.
Are you a college professor and you said a nice thing about Palestinians? Sorry, you're fired.
Yeah,
you're
fired. Try doing business in any Southern American state. You literally have to sign a checkbox with the state saying that your business will never boycott Israel.
Why are you doing the spot cam?
Oh, I just do that sometimes.
Because it's logical.
What we've learned.
It's called coordination.
Because during the second Intifada, while they were mowing down Palestinians crying the whole time, the Israeli answer is, well, where is the Mandela?
Yeah.
Where is the peaceful?
You just ran them over.
And there is no fucking peaceful protest that would be acceptable. Because this is not a thing that's negotiable.
Right.
Because the ethnostate isn't negotiable.
Right.
And that is where we are. And I wanted to end this because I think we want to move on to talk about the MS-13 and the domestic parameters of this panic about borders and control and
get to the fun part of the episode.
Contamination is that after Operation Barbarossa began, Heinrich Himmler gave a speech to a Waffen-SS battalion. And the quote that he said was, "It is a time of iron, and we must sweep with iron brooms." And I want to ask anybody who thinks of themselves as in solidarity with Israel or with America in its battle against these phantom terrorists or MS-13 or anything. Anybody who wants to protect the West, do you disagree with that idea?
Right.
And they don't. That is the presiding ideology of the West, quote unquote, that these people are trying to defend. Yep. The presiding ideology is the Nazi concept of complete domination and extermination or defeat. That is what we're living in.
Yep.
Are you ready to laugh?
All right, just to play us out, Thomas Friedman and anyone who looks like Thomas Friedman should never say the phrase "the flower of youth" ever again. It's fucking repulsive. Anyway, guys, on to sunnier days.
I did want to mention the
are there any memes in the news?
Ongoing border panic in this country. Just real quickly, this thing back, the MS-13 thing. Trump keeps talking about MS-13 every time he talks about immigration and the border and ICE and anything like that. We talked to Jake Flores just last week about how his run-in with DHS and over his joke about killing ICE agents. I saw the head of ICE testify this week crying in front of Congress because people were mean to him. They're literally talking about they're now literally separating children from their families and putting them on privately run concentration camps on military bases.
Yeah, because John Kelly said we're going to separate them and they'll go to foster care or whatever. And this is the week where we found out what whatever means, and whatever means concentration camps on military bases.
Well, for John Kelly, you know, foster care or whatever, that's a superior parenting choice to whatever he did. Superior parenting choice to sending them to Afghanistan or whatever. Good work, General Shithead.
So Trump said in one of his idiotic speeches, he's talking about, you know, they're chopping people's heads off. It's terrible, bad, no good. And, you know, everyone reacted to that like, oh, you know, this is disgusting that, again, he's comparing basically all Spanish-speaking people in this country to a violent machete-wielding street gang and, you know, connecting the two in the minds of his hog followers. Mm-hmm. And so that was the initial reaction. And then the sort of the turn was people who were like, now, we have to be very careful in the media. It was clear that he was just referencing MSNBC.
Okay, I'm actually fucking with him. Chris Hayes with a fucking like Santa Muerte tattoo on his forehead.
Rachel Maddow in a dark alley. Have we got some news for you? We're going to burn down your building unless we can sell in front of your corner.
Lawrence O'Donnell with just full grill.
And, you know, this idiotic back and forth about, oh, does Trump know what he's talking about, what he means when he does this? Who gives a shit? Yeah. The people who support his agenda know why this is useful.
Right.
And we saw a story this week about how ICE routinely designates people in their dragnet, like the Dreamers, as gang members, as part of MS-13 because they have a tattoo. And they're like, oh, that's a gang tattoo. Definitely a gang tattoo.
Yeah.
And they know it greases the skids for their ongoing, you know, just pipeline out of the country.
They're wearing
just
a Cardinals hat. That's red. That's a gang color.
Yeah, you know. And one of the things this week was this guy, I think he writes for the Daily Beast. His name is
Lachlan Marquet.
Lachlan Marquet. He had this comment where he was like, actually calling MS-13 animals, like, I don't, you know, protest, I don't think that's the hill to die on. You know, they are animals or whatever.
Yeah, he was is defending the humanity of gang members like MS-13 really the hill you guys want to die on.
And what I'll say to that is on a one-to-one, like, individual opinion basis, like, I could imagine being like, yeah, MS-13, like, they do crimes that I would say fairly might eject you from humanity or at least polite society.
Yeah.
That being said, for the government, yeah, that is the hill to die on.
Yeah.
The government classifying people as unhuman or subhuman. Yes. Yeah, no, that actually absolutely is the hill to die on.
And there were all these stories this week about a guy who was lumped into MS-13 because now it's just a way to slap a label, just like terrorism.
He had a tattoo on his arm that was literally just the town he was born in.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
And they said, that's a gang tattoo.
So he's an animal now, according to Mark Marquet.
That's the
bad Scrabble hand name he has.
Yeah, Lachlan Marquet sounds like an Indonesian businessman using a fake name to check into a hotel.
Yeah, to
like,
give you money.
The gang thing, like, this type of, like, Marquet-type media shithead, everything is taken in pure isolation, zero context. It's just, oh, are you saying gangs are okay? They're value neutral, maybe? And it's like, no, this is, like you said, this is good. Let's look at Hero of the Resistance, Preet Bharara. What was one of Preet Bharara's favorite things to do? It was to hit like black kids with Rico charges because of who their friends were on Facebook. Because guess what? They were gang affiliated.
Yep.
That's enough to throw federal Rico charges and give somebody a fucking gas price sentence who literally did nothing.
Well, it's like, Matt, it's like what you said before. It's all the things we're discussing link up because there are ways to eject someone from not just polite society, from
humanity.
Human rights. From human rights.
From having a right to anything.
They're not a citizen, or they're a gang member, or they're a felon, or they're a Palestinian terrorist. And it's like, well, the rules don't apply to them. Sorry. Just finding creative ways to make that tent bigger.
Yes.
And then saying, go hog wild. And that's what happens here.
We are in a situation where all of the brightest fucking minds of the media in the quote unquote first world are creating ways to make unpeople whose death won't trouble the masses.
Right.
Whose massacre and whose transportation and whose illegal arrest and detention will not trouble the mass of people. And the way to do that is to take them outside of the generally conceived of notion of a human being with human rights. And that is why these fucking hair-splitting scumbags trying to, well, actually Trump's obvious fucking dog whistle Nazism about animals are doing the work. They are indistinguishable from the fucking Julius Strikers and Alfred Rosenbergs of the 21st century. They are doing the work of the people who want to create new categories of unpeople to be disappeared and eliminated and destroyed without anybody batting an eyelash about it. And that, because if you really think that that fucking precious distinction that you want to fucking point out on Twitter between the MS-13 and, well, you know, he didn't specifically refer to all, but who is being arrested? We know who's being arrested in these fucking ICE crackdowns. They're dragging dads out of fucking hospital wards where their kids are being treated. We know who is going to fucking into these ICE detentions. Pregnant women, people who've been in America for fucking decades without any kind of brush with the law. We know that's what's happening. We see it every fucking day. And they want to say, well, when he says animals, he's not referring to them. And yet those people are getting the same fucking treatment as these MS-13 quote unquote animals.
Yep.
So what is the distinction meaningfully?
Yep.
And there is no meaningful distinction.
Yep.
And that is why it matters. And that is why anyone who wants to fucking parse this shit is doing the job of the future genocidaires.
Yep.
The fucking future Rwandan hate radio people who want to fucking cut down the tall trees and smash the fucking cockroaches.
By the way, look forward to Barry Weiss's tour of colleges coming up next year. Cut the tall trees, 2019. So, moving on. You know, it's been a dark show. We're talking about serious things, about the ways in which, you know, governments and the media dehumanize inconvenient populations that they'd rather not, you know, have around or deal with.
It's been a real weenie killer.
Yeah, it's been. And I have a reading series this week, the perfect person to check in on, that touches on this issue, but does so in the most hilarious way possible. I'm talking about Rod Dreher.
Ooh.
Mr. Too Damn Normal.
It's been a while. It's been a while since
since we talked about Rod Dreher.
And all those bathrooms I can't remember.
It's been a while since we've checked in with Brother Rod. Shout out to Roy and Rosso for founding this Rod piece. It's a Rod Dreher post from this week that he decides to take on the phenomenon that's been happening as of late that we've talked about on the last show with Jake Flores of white people being filmed calling the cops and shrieking at minorities and black people on the street. He's talking about the barbecue lady. The viral video of the woman calling the cops on those people in Oakland for grilling.
Oh, yeah.
This is coming on the heels of a week where we saw the amazing Aaron Schlossberg, the viral video star who is in not just one, but three separate videos filmed by three different people of three distinct instances of this guy behaving like a psychopath on the streets
that
of New York.
That dude is the Zelig of racism.
So it's been a big week for the very specific type of guy that Schlossberg is, which is the steakhouse and statement watch guy.
Yes.
Yeah. Schlossberg is like, he has like a David Blaine early tape of racism. Several different locations around New York. And he's like, I was hideously racist to a black person here. Actually, got a Salvadorian here. You'd never guess who I threatened to call ICE on here.
Yeah. So, and as you said, there were three different videos, all funnier than the last. Yeah. He just kept outdoing himself.
And then, the videos after that of him running away from the media were...
Yes.
Or he's hiding underneath an umbrella for 5 minutes.
Yep. Going, please help.
And then you can hear him from behind the umbrella at one point go, please send help.
Yes.
And that made my week.
Yep.
So, please send what, the Proud Boys?
It's a new superhero that only protects racist guys.
So, yeah, there's been a lot of these videos going around. So, you know, there's going to be people who have to find a way to be like, now, this looks bad for the people in the videos, but actually what's really bad is the people taking the videos.
Ooh.
And the mob mentality. Shout out to Julia Roffey for that fucking stinker.
Yeah.
Julia Roffey, you know,
Yaffe.
Her immediate instinct is to take the side of the monstrous asshole and not the people who are deservedly mocking his downfall.
I honestly don't give a shit about Julia Roffey. Like, it's just, I feel like every week it's like we have a new media asshole like that who I've never heard of. And I'm like, yeah, they suck. Okay. But the one funny thing about it was when she's like, look, I'm a political refugee. And she was born during Perestroika. moved here when she was three. Yeah, by that, like, I'm a refugee. The Midwest is very cold.
Yeah.
So, Rod Dreher, back to Rod. He's done a take on the barbecue lady video.
Yeah.
That goes to some pretty extraordinary places.
All right. And Kendall Powers.
And by the way, the funniest part of the video is the end of it, where the police come.
She starts crying.
And she starts crying and saying, I've been victimized.
So, Rod begins.
Checkmate.
Did you see the video of the white woman in Oakland who called the cops on some black people who were cooking
next question.
In a public park with a charcoal grill? My view is this. Unless they've set up the grill in your house or in the ICU, you leave people with charcoal grills alone because they are contributing to the sum total of human happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you think Rod is setting this up like, he's a reasonable man. He's going to take a reasonable point.
That's a brave, bipartisan, pro-grilling stance that we can all get behind, right, fellas?
Yeah, hey,
call this motherfucker Hank Hill.
He goes on and on, and he says, again, I believe the white woman may have been technically correct, but was morally wrong.
Wow.
Oh, my God. That is the old Rod I know.
Yeah, it drops off immediately.
Jumping right back into the game.
You can't ignore technical correctness when you see it. Okay?
Well, she said, Rod, every Rod article, he can hold it together for like maybe a sentence and a half. And he's like, y'all mind if I wow out? It's like, it'll start out and be like, of course, I don't think you should go into a bathroom with the Spaz 12 automatic shotgun with a flashlight attached. That's not good. People try. But
the guy
there are several exceptions.
Yeah.
Racist lady, you are technically correct. The best kind of correct.
he does say she was technically correct, but morally wrong. Okay. And besides, she's a pill. So you think that's
I can relate
she's
to this
She's an
guy.
Old maid.
Yeah. Okay, this Stanford wife motherfucker. Yeah.
So he goes, maybe the barbecue griper is a racist, but we have no reason to assume that.
No.
Maybe she's just a petty.
Zero.
Maybe she's just a petty person who sees a violation of the law and went all nanny state. So he's going on and on like this. And
maybe she's just an asshole that we would all hate anyway.
Maybe she's a Democrat.
Yeah, I like how he's actually saying she's a liberal. Actually,
that's a Rod like behind the back pass.
Absolutely,
that's his sneaky play.
that's why you play the game.
That's why he's the best, dude.
So here's where it gets interesting. You know, Rod describes what happened in his inimitable fashion and creates several outs for this woman to be anything other than what she appears as. So he goes, here's a story. So Rod's dipping back into his mind palace for instances from his real life that he's going to share.
Oh, no.
So
I was just calmly barbecuing in my own backyard, and somebody said, hey, Whitey.
No, he goes, here's...
Michelle Obama called me Whitey.
Here's a story. We lived in an apartment complex not too long ago. There were three young unmarried guys living in the flat above ours. They would get loud on the weekend. We decided that being good neighbors meant that we should put up with banging and hooting until 10 p.m.
I'll put up with hooting, but not for a second will I tolerate hollering.
But not after that, because that was bedtime.
Okay.
The first few occasions, we went up to ask them to knock it off. They were nice about it, but then they got obnoxious, usually after they had been drinking. Finally, one night, after multiple attempts to ask them to stop, we had to call the apartment security people. We didn't want to be those neighbors, but they left us no choice. The difference is that those bad neighbors were causing actual harm.
yelling and banging on the floor and playing loud music until late in the night.
Harm.
They were literally harm. Slapping the floor like with hammers.
They were playing. They were auditioning for an off-Broadway production of Stomp.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm picturing Rod Stabers just like a conga line of three men wearing lampshades over their
look,
head.
Okay, you try living below a old-timey jug band where one person will not stop scraping on a washboard
let me tell you
the other
story.
is blowing into a jug at all hours of the night.
That's the thing. Rod is one of those people who, like, his experiences are formed by movies, but because he's, like, sort of like a vintage, weird, like, vintagey guy, all those movies are, like, actually just radio plays like Fibber McGee and Molly. And he's like, yeah, you know what young men do, just hooting and hollering.
Let me tell you the story of when I lived next to the Fat Albert gang. And they were playing drums on trash cans.
I used to have an apartment that was beneath the rehearsal space for Gold Diggers of 33.
Do I regret the fact that the country bear jamboree was massacred by the police after I called them on them? Yes. But I still think I was in the right.
Rod Dreher walking into a Chuck E. Cheese and just seeing it in Terminator vision.
Okay, here's where it gets interesting. So he goes, the people grilling in the park were not harming Barbecue Griper one bit.
Barbecue Griper replied to your post. Interesting take from a neo-cuck bug man.
Barbecue Griper, still... Had the jerks upstairs been three young black guys, not white guys, I wonder if I would have said anything to them at all for fear of them turning it into a racial confrontation. If I had called apartment security on them, like I eventually did with the white guys after they ignored our repeated requests to stop banging on the floor, would they have confronted me in the parking lot with a smartphone camera, calling me a racist and distributing it to social media?
It is a crisis in this country of white people being afraid to call the police.
Okay. And turning me into a racist pariah. That griping white woman's life must be miserable today now that she's become a meme. Who wants that? I noticed that many places on the internet celebrating the public shaming of the white woman never stop to ask whether or not this is a proportionate to her offense. What I love here is that this is a favorite tactic of mine among all the conservative intelligentsia, and that is inventing scenarios in their head and then getting angry at what happens in their imagination.
So, looking at this story of this obviously racist or incredibly anal retentive woman.
Yeah.
Like, either she's a racist or she is the most psychotically rural fixated person on Earth, making this ridiculously wasteful call to the cops in this situation. It made Rob Dreher mad at imaginary black men.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
I love black men who literally do not exist.
Yep. And I love that Rod's fear, it wasn't like, they'll kill me with their hip hop gun. It's like his usual type of thing. It's like they're gonna make me into a meme.
Yeah.
They're gonna post me and say that they had to do it to him. Yeah. That's it. Does she really deserve that to become a meme?
Yeah.
Like damn Daniel.
By the way, I also like about
does a man deserve to be dabbed on just because he's trying to sleep?
What I also like about Rod here is that he says, like, imagine being turned into a pariah. You're Mr. Benedict option. You want to be a pariah.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't live in the fucking woods.
Yeah, imagine being exposed for all your weird and creepy fantasy. Yeah. You do it yourself, Rod. You volunteer it.
You write a column every week where it's like, well, yeah, I saw another piece of driftwood that looked like a nipple. I definitely whipped myself. I have thrown my computer into the river. Yeah. Anyway, just answer some questions.
So he goes,
if he's so worried about becoming a meme, someone should have him listen to the show.
Yeah, exactly.
We've turned this motherfucker into a meme plenty of times.
I don't think Rod is a meme. Like, it's too inaccessible for people. It's like, imagine, so in the past year,
Rod is lore. He's not a meme.
It's lore.
Right.
Yeah.
Rod is lore.
So you probably are just barely getting to the point where you can explain to, like, extended family members what your job is.
Yes.
Imagine now explaining to them what Rod Dreher is. Can you picture yourself doing that?
Point of clarification, the woman who recorded Kenny Powers Lady, the barbecue griper, is named Michelle Snyder. She's another white woman. And Rod writes here, but it's easy to imagine yourself tormented by a harridan like Michelle Snyder, the woman with the camera phone, and knowing what came next for her, national infamy thanks to social media, is pretty horrifying. This is the next paragraph. If you read Ta-Nehisi Coates' big book...
Wow. Oh, no. So, who allowed Rod to get his hands on
that? He then goes on to quote extensively from Ta-Nehisi and then quote his own review of Ta-Nehisi Coates' book at length. Here's where it gets really good, guys. When Rod dips into the mailbag.
So this
is pretty good so far, right, guys?
Yeah, like Rod just spit a hot 32, and he's like, let me get some of my little homies on the beat. We have Terrified in Baton Rouge.
Yeah. No, I just...
Rod, there's a shape in my closet that looks like a New Era cap with the sticker still on. I shot 87 bullets into there. Yeah, Rod, is that normal? Yes.
Before we get to that, just we need to examine what we've seen here, which is that Rob Dreher saw a story of a woman who is clearly racially panicked and called the cops on people who were doing literally nothing.
Yeah.
And his thought was, yeah, but what if they had been doing something?
Yeah. Okay, wait till you get to this reader. This is update number two. Reader Dunn writes, and by the way, as a longtime fan of Rod's, there is an open question in the Rod community whether these reader letters are just Rod writing to himself.
I honestly think that we are witnessing a M. Night Shyamalan joint here.
No, Rod
is split two.
Yeah. Fuck that. Rod is the child from Saint Elsewhere.
Yeah.
Yes. Listen to this.
The snow globe is just a fucking bathroom.
Listen to this. Note to Rod, this is going to be a rant, so feel free to edit or even toss.
Understand.
You are now entering the rant zone.
Entering the rant zone, babe. Still ranting after all these years.
Yep, that was great.
All right. This reader letter is incredible. Okay. He goes, Reader Dunn writes, okay, I've read most of the comments. Clearly none of you live in Oakland. If you did, I'm certain your reactions to this incident would be different. If you were sane, that is. I know because I've lived there for over 20 years, including near Lake Merritt, the location of this incident. First, let's dispense with the notion that this was a racially motivated incident between a white woman and some black folks. This lady is not white. Repeat after me. The lady is not white.
What?
It is clear to me from her facial features and body type that her racial and ethnic background is mixed, possibly white and Pacific Islander.
Oh my God. I did not see that coming.
This began with feel free to edit this. What did Rod take out that this is what remains?
So he's setting up this whole thing where it's just like, why do we always assume that this is racial? And his reader, his fan is like, I'm an expert in skull types and phablo groups.
Yeah.
This woman is not white.
Look, this woman is at least 1/32nd Uyghur. So she is not white.
He goes, possibly white and Pacific Islander, which would not be uncommon in the Bay Area.
Commander Dreher, the area is crawling with mixed types of islandoids.
Listen to this. When you live in a racially and ethnically diverse area for a long time, you begin to detect and distinguish ethnic and racial differences and any combinations thereof that often go unnoticed by people who have not been exposed to such racial diversity. Again, the race mixing Terminator.
This guy's sitting in fucking El Pollo Loco in line and just like evaluating the racial breakdown,
like by his vision
of everyone he sees, and then he's like, people who don't live here would never be able to distinguish that this person is a Frisian.
I have always wondered about Northern California because my favorite and mentally unwell at times. MMA fighters are from there. The Diaz brothers, Dan Quinn is from there. It's a absurd area. The people there seem to love driving around in their cars and making videos addressed at their enemies, then crashing their cars.
Yes.
But then it's like, then you see this, like this guy who like gets behind people's Toyota Siennas and like licks the tire track and goes, that's a Polynesian type. And it's like, the ones I know about are the most normal ones. Yeah. Like Dan Quinn is probably a pillar in his community for Northern California.
Guys, it's not just this letter gets even more normal as it goes on.
Wow. How?
There's a second point he's making. I'm going to play the sex card here, even though I don't normally do this, but whoa.
Sex card.
The comments here are pretty well sexist. Nosy, busybody, killjoy, grouchy, old. Oh, sure. She's a regular Mrs. Kravitz. Google the reference if you don't get it.
It's Lenny Kravitz's mom, and I will tell you what race that bitch is.
I always get the reference that's from Bewitched.
Yep. Yeah, I'm fairly certain most of you wouldn't have used those words to describe her if she were a man. Why don't you just toss in frigid for good measure? Just saying. Next, let me explain to everyone how things work in Oakland. They don't.
Oh.
Nobody, and I mean nobody, respects common courtesy and the rule of law. Not to mention bothers to comport themselves appropriately in public spaces. Mm. The area around Lake Merritt is in complete chaos all the time.
Again, if you see the video, it's a beautiful park.
It's completely normal scene in a park.
Literally just standing around cooking meat on a grill.
It's chaos. No one will tell me what race they are.
Are they even playing music? I don't even remember if there's like
no,
loud.
There's no music.
They're just standing there making food.
He yelled at them because they were playing like Kenny Chesney, and they're like, he's like, this is fucking up my spreadsheets. Yeah. This is one of the race identifiers I use.
All the time. Why was this petty, nosy, busybody, so-called white woman calling the police over such a seemingly innocuous incident as people wanting to barbecue using charcoal? Maybe because the city of Oakland is located in a severe high fire danger area and it's against the law. Oakland Hills fire of 1991, anyone? Google images, I survived it.
But that's the thing. It wasn't illegal to cook there. It was that they were using, I don't even fucking remember. That's how petty it was. It was like, they weren't using the ones that were provided. They were using their own or vice versa. Either way, It was
a name thing that no normal human being would see another person doing that and think, I got to call the police.
Can we stop disrespecting the experience of a fire survivor?
Yeah.
This guy. Yeah. He's one of mine. I see him in the meetings. But yeah,
he survived the Oakland fire.
Yeah.
Come get your man, Felix.
This guy, he's transcended, but this is the most Seth Rogen observe and report guy.
Oh, yes, he is. I observed in my perimeter that there was someone violating fire codes.
By the way, all I know about the Oakland Hills fires of 1991 is that it was one of the disaster scenarios you could play in SimCity 2000.
It was.
It ruled.
That in Flint, Michigan.
And it was caused by a rowdy pack of black hooligans barbecuing without a permit.
Yeah, dude, you think SimCity is hard? Try playing it on expert race identifier mode.
Okay, so
your city has no police, so the National Guard has been deployed.
Yeah. So going on from Travis Bickle's diary, he goes, and why does a citizen have to report someone breaking the law? Because people regularly, openly, and brazenly break the law in Oakland, and asking them nicely to desist does not work. And what does the Oakland PD do? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's why she was waiting for over 2 hours for the police to respond. I'm surprised they came at all. My car was stolen, and did the police come when I reported it? No.
Owned.
Yeah. So this goes on and on and on, and he goes, talking about miscreants in his neighborhood, threatening to kill him, and then just on and on and on.
I live by this young man named Dennis who's constantly getting in my business, stealing pies from my windowsill.
This is the only guy left in America who gets bullied by a gang that's like Jeff Goldblum with a mohawk.
this young man named Bart destroyed my memoirs.
Yeah.
And my,
his
father is also bad, but I don't remember. What was the name of the man? Yeah. I don't remember.
By the way, my mental image of this person is conservative grandpa.
But that's the thing, is that that's clearly a crank.
Yeah.
That's a maniac. And like many neighborhoods have, just a psychotic person who cannot handle other people existing and is just driven to abstraction by other people being in their field of vision. But the fact that fucking Rod felt like he needed to give this maniac that much real estate in his column really speaks to how Rod, for all of his pretensions to being some sort of neo fucking gothic intellectual, is just a cranky fucking weirdo.
But Matt.
It goes on like, so he goes, what I see from this video is a relatively reserved woman reporting illegal behavior and being absolutely harangued by the woman filming the incident, who assumed, one, that this woman was white, and two, that she was motivated by race.
I'm sorry, but did this woman have calipers? Yeah. I don't think so. Oh, if you do not have calipers on your person, you are not qualified to speak on the race of anyone who you're interacting with.
Well, if you live in Oakland for 20 years, you get the perk that lets you identify races and puts it on the mini map.
OMG. Are you kidding me? The woman who filmed the incident and browbeat the other woman to tears should be ashamed of herself. I think her behavior even meets the requirements of menacing. And another criminal statute. This guy's
so excited.
He's got the entire California criminal code tattooed on the inside of his eye.
He goes, there's, you know, SJW virtue signaling, PC bullshit, run amok.
Check.
He says PC BS, run amok.
Check.
He goes, this is my favorite part. And now this poor woman is being viciously attacked on social media. Have you seen the memes? They're brutal. So it goes on like this for another 1,000 words, sure, at least, talking about a pregnant woman who was shot and killed in Oakland. Just okay. Death wish, yeah, everything. It goes on and on. Murder.
You let somebody cook in a public park, and then the next day, they're massacring pregnant
He's
women.
He's going, civility and decency are dead in Oakland. Rip. They're dead in California, and soon they'll be dead in the entire United States. Going on, cold-blooded murder in broad daylight. Blah, blah, blah. Keep it up, Oakland. Pretty soon there won't be one decent law-abiding citizen left.
White person.
Because lawlessness and incivility are rewarded and responsible citizenship is vilified.
Decent person means non-Polynesian white.
Rod's postscript to this gigantic letter is, any Oakland or former Oakland readers want to challenge this?
I'm sorry, but if I don't have any other readers who are completely insane and live in this guy's zip code, I'm gonna have to take what he says for granted. I'm sorry.
Hey Rod, another reader from Oakland here. Yeah, you know, I may have gone a different skill tree than this guy. I could usually only identify types of Latinos. This guy seems to have the Pacific Islander yeah. perk.
But I mean, I remember some of these stories. There was one story I read about a woman in it wasn't that app, but it was one of those Facebook groups
for neighborhood watch things. Yeah,
and
yeah.
it was a teen showed up at her door with a solo cup because they were going to a party in the neighborhood and they didn't know where it was. And he said, is this person's house? And they said, no, and they left. And she took a picture of him, and she put a post where she said, there are teens running around the neighborhood. They might have cups of acid. They might be throwing acid at you.
Oh my
There's
God.
Something about suburbia that makes people mostly
not
insane.
The drug acid, oh, like throwing acid.
No,
in
literal
people's face.
Acid in your face.
Well, like we could do an entire stuff. Episode about suburbia.
Suburban mania is important. But the thing I want to point out is that the guy says all this law is being violated and no one is doing it. And the thing is that every person listening to this violates the law every fucking day. Everyone does.
I'm violating three of them
Everyone
right now.
Everyone violates the law all the fucking time. And what matters materially is who gets held accountable right. for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is a racial caste system, essentially, is yeah. that everybody is like just trying to live their life. Some people violate statutes, and the statutes that get fucking enforced are the statutes that are enforced by racial strata.
Yeah.
And that's the thing to remember. So this motherfucker acting like, oh, you people, you're flaunting the law. No, that everyone's flaunting the law all the time. It's these people who are being disproportionately enforced on laws that everybody breaks all the time.
Thanks, Boner Law.
Thank you for the measured response to the guy who sleeps in a ghillie suit in Oakland.
Just to close out on Rod. What I like about here is Rod begins attempting to make like a point that a normal human being would, but ends up going completely opposite. Yep. And inescapably, one would have to conclude that either Rod himself or his readers are all deeply insane.
Can we throw it to Brendan?
Sure. So,
oh man.
Wow, it's been a packed show today. We've covered a lot of ground.
Every emotion.
It's been the whole colors of the rainbow we've experienced today. And we'd like to close now with a reading from our own book, The Chapo Guide to Revolution, in stores August 21st.
Oh, by the way, I want to say something very quickly.
You can do it at the very end.
Well, no, I just want to say something right now.
Okay.
Buy the book.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Good point.
The Chapo Guide to Revolution, in stores August 21st, available to pre-order now. Brendan James, take us away. The world premiere reading from the book.
Thanks, guys. So this is the media chapter. You know, we don't sign each chapter, but I think Virgil and I worked on this one the most. And I'm just going to start at the very beginning and read you
a bit of the introduction that in which we track the history of American journalism to where it ended up today. Extry, extry, read all about it. Daring dirtbags disrupt daffy Democrats' discombobulated discourse. That's how this chapter might have read if we still lived in the ink-stained era of print news. Today, however, virtually all Americans get their news, opinions, and pornography through the internet. How did we get from dead... Oh, this is so bad. How did we get from dead logs...
Shut up, I wrote that.
I know. How did we get from dead logs to live blogs? From editorial boards to circuit boards.
Fuck.
Put on your newsboy cap and read on, because Chapo Trap House has the scoop. That's in quotation marks. Scoop. Okay, so this is a section called Sir, Have You No Shame, Sir? A History of Journalism. The first mass-produced newspapers emerged in Germany shortly after the invention of the printing press. They included Relation aller Formenien und Glendinwichtigen Historien, which translates as Account of All Distinguished and Commemorable News, and List der bekannten Juden, List of Known Jews. These publications disseminated vital information about the current affairs to the literate masses. The concept spread to London, where gazetters on Fleet Street added such innovations as editorials and the page three slags. Across the Atlantic, a media culture flourished in the 13 colonies, where the issues of the day were hotly debated within the pages of newsletters and pamphlets. Among the early commentators was a young publisher's apprentice named Benjamin Franklin. He was a polymath and the first true American man of letters in that he generated reams and reams of extremely horny correspondence. As a sexual degenerate who disseminated totally useless advice to the ignorant masses, a sample aphorism, the fool wakes up to the cuckoo's crow whilst the wise man rises to the songbird of reason. Ben Franklin was also our nation's first pundit. Out of the colonist pamphleteering culture emerged an uncompromising devotion to freedom of speech, which produced such widely read radical polemics as Common Sense and No Taxation Without Fringeless Flags. After the Revolution, ratification of the proposed U.S. Constitution was hotly debated through the competing serials, such as the Federalist Papers, and the massively more popular, wow, I had no idea about these 10 Bills of Rights. Number 6 will shock you. American journalism in the first part of the 19th century consisted mostly of libelous attacks on politicians' illegitimate octoroon children, classified ads for bounties on escaped slaves, and advice columns. Newspapers tended to be partisan outlets, loyal to single-issue parties like the Anti-Masonics and the Hose Down the Irish League. Some periodicals, however, were brave enough to challenge entrenched power. Notable among them was Harper's Weekly, which ran Thomas Nast's political cartoons depicting corrupt politicians as rotund gluttons with dollar signs adorning bags over their heads, part of the American media's long and disgraceful legacy of body shaming, and showing the Catholic clergy as vicious crocodiles crawling out of the Potomac to hunt for children, part of the American media's long and honorable tradition of truth-telling. But such publications were few and far between. The progressive movement spawned a class of hard-nosed investigative journalists who dedicated their lives to rooting out corruption, challenging the entrenched power of monopolists, exposing the horrifying conditions in which the working classes lived, and doing their best to make sure those working classes didn't breed too prodigiously. Fearless muckrakers like Upton Sinclair, Ida Tarbell, and Jacob Riis showed how dedicated journalists could improve the lives of the millions by doggedly pursuing the truth. But most journalists were not fearless muckrakers. 99% of news hawks, what we like to call hacks. In this era, long before Columbia J School and valuable resume-building unpaid internships, the job of reporting the news was not the province of fail-sons of the educated upper class like it is today. Indeed, instead, most journalists were the children of impoverished immigrants. They were the seventh sons of a proletariat deemed too sickly and weak to pursue a respectable child labor trade like coal runner or triangle shirt waster. These young cowards were plucked from the slums at an early age and sold to the Hearst Corporation. The media industry put these amorphous lumps of raw humanity through a brutal baptism by fire. The cubs were instilled with a healthy fear of challenging entrenched power, taught to fairly report on both sides of any given issue, such as women's suffrage or lynching, and totally sequestered from contact with females so they would emerge from their chrysalids as weird sexual neurotics. The one who survived earned the right to call themselves bona fide journalists. Some of them became investigative reporters, adopting the moniker Gumshoe, a reference to their habit of stopping women on the street and offering to inspect their feet for grime, often even going so far as to offer a thorough tongue cleaning free of charge. The cream of the crop became pundits, regular columnists paid to pontificate about every single issue, with special emphasis on the issues they knew absolutely nothing about. In the rapidly modernizing world of the 1920s, when women's skirts were getting shorter and wearable tech like polio braces proliferated, the common man relied on these noble perverts to analyze, predict, and explain. To today's reader, the concept of an individual possessing a perfectly average level of intelligence and education at best, shitting out half-baked analyses of complex political and social matters to be closely read by millions as if they were the divinely inspired words of a prophet descending a mountaintop, may seem absurd. But remember, that people were stupid back then and didn't have Yahoo Answers and our legal advice to explain things to them. Some examples of punditry from the early 20th century. Union organizers are murdered in some parts of the country, and that's okay. Why we need a second Great War to toughen up the entitled greatest generation. What my rickshaw driver taught me about Nanking, the next up-and-coming global hotspot. Limiting the work week to just 80 hours will hurt the people it's meant to help. Spanish flu or Spanish boo-hoo? New influenza, nothing to worry about. We need to talk about Al. We need to talk about Al Jolson. Is he ashamed of being white? Civility and compromise. Why the Weimar Republic will last for 1,000 years.
Oh my fucking God.
So that's a snippet from our media chapter.
Damn, that's a good book. Woo. You should all buy
snap,
it.
Everybody snap.
Yeah, you should that buy that the, shit. That sounds
the,
good.
That was the
buy
first,
it now.
That was a pre-order available now.
Buy
that
the
was our
book,
first reading. There'll be more readings to come to juice you, to entice you to buy this wonderful tome that we've all written. Yeah.
Before we go, I have two statements.
We're going to wrap it up today, but we have two quick notes from Virgil.
Number one, buy the book. Folks,
buy the book.
Buy the book.
Buy the book. Book.
You like the book. Buy the book.
It was delightful. You want to read the book. Buy the book.
You want to buy the book. Buy the book.
Buy the book.
Number two, I want to give a shout out to our Irish friends who will be voting this week on repealing the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution.
Get rid of that shite.
And essentially legalizing abortion.
Yeah,
in
that's
Ireland.
Right.
You'll be voting to repeal the Eighth, and polls show repeal winning. But you know what? We've seen in recent elections, nobody knows. Yeah. So, Aaron, go to the polls and vote. Vote to repeal the Eighth.
repeal the fucking Eighth.
Much love to our Irish friends.
Repeal the fucking Eighth, man.
Also, if you're in Ireland, buy the book.
Mm. Buy the fucking book. Put the book in a fairy ring.
Till next time, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.